And I want to encourage you, if you have a Bible, to take out your Bible. We're going to read again this morning from the first book of the Bible, the book of Genesis. So if you have a Bible with you or a Bible available on a device that you have, it's the first book of the Bible. And we're looking again at the story of Joseph. So when I've read the Bible before and thought about Joseph, especially how the story begins, if you were here last week, we were talking about Joseph and his dreams. And I used to think about Joseph. Joseph was a naive, kind of arrogant, prideful young man. He shared his dreams with his brothers and even his father. He shouldn't have done that. He was... maybe a stereotypical, I'm not saying this is true of all teenagers, but you know, he was kind of full of himself, and he was showing his family, and that's why he got into trouble. And when John Lowe was preaching last week, I thought, well, that's not really what the Bible's saying. The Bible is saying that Joseph was a prophet. He's bringing these dreams, and these dreams come true. And because of the coat he's wearing or the robe he's wearing, now most of us think it was a multicolored coat or a technicolored coat, but we really don't know. The word in the Hebrew, nobody really knows what that word means, but it was a special kind of robe or a special kind of coat. And if you keep reading the Bible, you realize the use of the word for that robe, as John Lowe said last week, is used of priests. Priests wore robes, same word. And people in the royal family wore robes, the same word. So he is a prophet, he is a priest, he is like a king. That's what the Bible's trying to show us. And when we hear that, at least some of us should think prophet, priest, and king, that's like Jesus. So as we move through these sermons this summer, one of our goals is to point the story of Joseph to Jesus. And I just go one more time to that new window, etched window there in our foyer, which says, "We preach Christ crucified." It was the message of the early church 2,000 years ago, and is meant to still be the message of the church today. Jesus Christ becomes the theme of the church, but also the theme of Sunday mornings and the theme of our messages. So especially these summer sermons, we're trying to focus on the story of Joseph, but also pointing us to the story of Jesus. I'm going to invite Fung to come up, or Maggie, one of you, someone. Genesis 37, verses 12 to 36.
Joseph sold by his brothers. Now his brothers had gone to graze their father's flocks near Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, "As you know, your brothers are grazing the flocks near Shechem. Come, I'm going to send you to them." "Very well," he replied. So he said to him, "Go and see if all is well with your brothers and with the flocks, and bring word back to me." Then he sent him off from the valley of Hebron. When Joseph arrived at Shechem, a man found him wandering around in the fields and asked him, "What are you looking for?" He replied, "I'm looking for my brothers. Can you tell me where they are grazing their flocks?" "They have moved on from here," the man answered. "I heard them say, 'Let's go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them near Dothan. But he saw him in the distance, and before he reached them, they plotted to kill him. "Here comes that dreamer," they said to each other. "Come now, let's kill him and throw him into one of these cisterns and say that a ferocious animal devoured him. Then we'll see what comes of his dreams." When Reuben heard this, he tried to rescue him from their hands. "Let's not take his life," he said. "Don't shed any blood. Throw him into the cistern here in the wilderness, but don't lay a hand on him." Reuben said this to rescue him from them, and take him back to his father. So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him off his robe, the ornate robe he was wearing, and they took him and threw him into the cistern. The cistern was empty. There was no water in it. As they sat down to eat their meal, they looked up and saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead. Their camels were loaded with spices, balm, and myrrh, and they were on their way to take them down to Egypt. Judah said to his brothers, "What will we gain if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him. After all, he is our brother, our own flesh and blood." His brothers agreed. So when the midnight merchants came by, his brothers pulled Joseph up out of the cistern and sold him for 20 shekels of silver to the Ishmaelites, who took him to Egypt. When Reuben returned to the cistern and saw that Joseph was not there, he tore his clothes. He went back to his brothers and said, "The boy isn't there. Where can I turn now?" Then they got Joseph's robe, slaughtered a goat, and dipped the robe into the blood. They took the ornate robe back to their father and said, "We found this. Examine it to see whether it is your son's robe." He recognized it and said, "It is my son's robe. Some ferocious animals have devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces." Then Jacob tore his clothes, put on sackcloth, and mourned for the son many days. All his sons and daughters came to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. "No," he said, "I will continue to mourn until I draw my son in the grave." So his father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold Joseph in Egypt to Potiphar, one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard.
Thanks, Maggie. It's a bit of a longer reading this morning. I'm going to invite you to gather in little groups. Groups of four, five, six people right where you are. And what's this story about? What's this story saying? If you were speaking this morning, what would you say about this story? I'm always thankful you're willing to do that. I know some of you could speak for a lot longer, so when I open up the floodgates, I know some of you wish the gates were open longer, but we always have after the service. You know, the sermon in some sense can continue after the service in your vehicles or on the bus or into your homes. Maybe partly when I say that, I mean what I might say, what I will say, but also especially engagement with the text. What did the text say? Now, I would love to hear all of you share what you talked about. I'm not going to do that right now. I do want to acknowledge that the story, very basically, if we were listening a little bit this morning, is about Jacob and Joseph and the brothers. And this awful moment, I'm going to get to that in a little bit, but this awful moment of selling your brother into slavery. I mean, for those who have heard the story many times, we say, "Oh, yeah, we know that part of the story, and we know what happens after." But selling your brother or your sibling into slavery, someone, while you're reading it, has to say, "What? What's going on?" So the story is about Jacob and Joseph and the brothers, but this morning I want to say it's about a father. It's about a father who sends his most beloved son to find out what's happening to the other brothers at Shechem. And when I start talking a little bit generically, I know it sounds generic, a father and a son, And he's sending the beloved son somewhere dangerous. I'm going to say Shechem is a dangerous place. Hopefully that for some of us, we start thinking that sounds like another story about a father who sent his son into a dangerous world. Now, Shechem is dangerous, and we're just going to put this on the screen here. I'm going to try and show you a little bit of what's going on here, because I don't know until I start researching what's happening in the text. Why these places? Here is where Joseph begins from, and he's going up to Shechem, so it's past Jerusalem. And if you were to read the book of Genesis a few chapters earlier, an awful event happens at Shechem. Genesis chapter 34. It's an event there's abuse and revenge and killing and gross misconduct that happens in that story. And two of Jacob's sons are involved in that. They actually end up killing a whole lot of people for what one man does to their sister. It's an awful story. And when I read stories like that, but other stories also, I mean, if you were to read the next chapter, Genesis 38, another awful story, I want to have you recognize that the family of Jacob is not a family to emulate. When I read stories like Genesis 34, Genesis 38, other things going on that these brothers do, our chapter this morning as well, I think of them like a mafia family. Like these guys are really bad guys. And that's who Jacob sends his beloved son to. These really bad brothers at Shechem. Now the son, Joseph, but the son goes. He goes at the request of the father to find out how these brothers are. And I was reading that the distance from Hebron, where they are, to Shechem is about 80 kilometers. One study Bible said because of the terrain, up and down and rugged and rough, it's not just walking through a nice park, maybe 5 days on foot, if he's going by foot. So I'm assuming he is. Maybe he's on a donkey, I'm not sure. But I'm assuming he's walking to Shechem, 17 years of age. I'm not sure if other people are with him, but if the study Bible is right, he's gone 5 days walking to Shechem, this awful place. Well, I should say where something awful happened. So that's quite a journey. And then he gets there, and Joseph finds out the brothers aren't at Shechem. They're actually at Dothan, another 24 kilometers away. So I'm thinking another maybe day or two of travel. So he's gone a week. That's a lot of traveling to find out how your brothers are. And then for me, most amazing of all, he's going to brothers who hate him. But not just hate him, as we found out in last week's message, they hate him. Three times in those earlier verses in this chapter, we find out the brothers hate Joseph. And when your family, if you have family that hates you that much, you're going to know it. If you have siblings or people around you who hate you, you're going to know that. So this morning, I'm suggesting that Joseph goes on a long journey, a tough journey. He goes further than he has to. I think he could have said, Dad, I went to Shechem. They weren't there. I've come back. But no, he goes another day or two to find his brothers, and he goes into a hostile group. His brothers are hostile toward him. He knows that. So I want to have us, get the sense of Joseph on a journey, the son on a journey, going further than he has to, going to people who hate him. And what the brothers do, although we can summarize it very quickly, but the narrative, if you look at how much Maggie read, most of what she read is this plot or this heinous act to eventually, they first want to kill him. But eventually, they sell him into slavery. And as we read through the narrative, we realize they see him at a distance. So he's probably maybe coming over a hill or something. Or there he is. They recognize him because he has a robe on that they hate, that robe. But they can see him coming. And even in the distance, they want to kill him. He's not even, you know, within shouting distance, probably. Not even close. They already are hatching a plan to kill him. And then I find it very conniving. Well, we don't want to kill him. Let's throw him in a cistern. Maybe he'll die in the cistern. So I found online a picture of a cistern, which when I see this picture, now you might say, oh, where's the cistern from? Well, this is from, it's from Israel. It's a southern part of Israel. You can go there and see the cistern if you want to, from a place called Arad. And the date on this cistern is about 1500 BC, around there. Now, this is not the cistern Joseph was in. It's not the same area. But, you know, this looks like a deep well, deep hole. You're not going to get out very easily. It gives me a mental image of what that cistern might have been like. So they throw him in a cistern, I think, thinking he might die in that cistern. We don't have to do it ourselves. But then, you know, other maybe cooler heads prevail. After they rip off his robe and throw him in the cistern, well, let's sell him to this caravan coming by. Which, if we just go back to the previous slide, I don't have it on the screen here, but there was a trade route, and it's well documented, the way of the sea, for people coming from over here, Babylonia, Persia, and the way of the sea went right through Israel, right by the Mediterranean Sea, as best as I could find out on the map, very close to Dothan. So when I read those kinds of things, I think, man, this story makes sense, right? I know there's a well, it's not in the same place, but a deep well they found about the time of Joseph. So they could make wells back then. And to have a caravan, if a caravan came through Hebron, that would be suspicious. We'd say, oh, the writer's making that up. But the caravan came through Dothan, which is very close, like right on this trade routes. So it makes sense that these traders would show up. And then this, and I don't know if I have the right word. I dare not use inappropriate language this morning, but this selling into slavery. We have to be able just to enter that moment for just a bit. And, you know, what if, for those of us who have siblings, like, can we imagine that? We hate you so much, we want to kill you, but we're going to give you to these slave traders, and they're going to bring you away, and we will never see you again. Good riddance. That's how much we hate you. And hate is one of those things that's so difficult to explain. Because when people hate each other, we might say, well, he's got that robe. He told us those dreams. You know, he told us we're going to bow down to him. But it's like everything they say, you think, and you sold him into slavery for that? You hate him for that? I mean, maybe he's arrogant. Maybe he's cocky. Maybe he's got these crazy dreams you don't understand, but you sold him into slavery for that? That's what hatred does in our lives. Beyond what's logically or but beyond what would make sense. I mean, I can understand how you might not like that robe and you wish, maybe you want to steal it from him. But to want to kill him and then eventually sell him into slavery, that's what hatred does when people hate others. Now, For the most part, this is a pretty awful story. There is grace. There is good news in this story. I just go back to the love of the father. A father who loves his son so much. What's happening to them? I want to go back to the willingness of the son to go that far to try and find his brothers and to go into enemy territory. Many commentators that I had looked at and pastors I heard talked about this caravan that seems to show up at just the right moment. What's going to happen to Joseph? Here comes the caravan, and although it looks like he is going into slavery, that's not very nice, the caravan in some sense saves him from death. And then, for those of us who know the story, especially the story of Joseph, but also the story of the Bible, this awful story is part of a bigger story. Right? So hopefully we're not going to get stuck this morning thinking how awful that story was. It is awful. I want to go a bit deeper this morning how awful it is. But I also want to recognize that there is a bigger story. That for those of us who don't know the Joseph story, God is working it for good. But that's later on. But this morning I want to see if we can enter the story a little bit. So we have the love of the Father, we have the persistence of the Son, we have the hatred of these brothers, and I'm trying to imagine Joseph there in the cistern. This passage doesn't tell us what was happening to Joseph. There is no mention of, was he upset? Well, of course he is, but there's no mention of that. But later on in the story, chapter 42, the brothers are in Egypt. Joseph is now the second in command in Egypt. And they're talking to each other, and they say, surely we're being punished because of our brother. 20 years earlier, this event in 37, chapter 37. Surely we're being punished. We saw how distressed he was when he pleaded with us for his life. So that gives me some sense of what's happening down the cistern, down the well. Joseph is screaming and crying and, please don't kill me. And when I read that from Genesis 42, I think about, and now I'm making a connection, I think about the life of Jesus. In the New Testament, we're told in Hebrews chapter 5 that during the days of Jesus' life on earth, he offered up prayers and petitions with fervent cries and tears to the one who could save him from death. So we have a crying Joseph, and we have a crying Jesus. And I want to suggest to you that in some ways, Joseph in the cistern, this is his Garden of Gethsemane. Not exactly the same like Jesus, but very much, where is this going? And for those of us who know the story, we might say, well, it's going to be okay, Joseph. You're going to go to Egypt. There are going to be some tough times there, but eventually this story will turn out for good. But I want to say this morning that for Joseph in this story, Genesis 37, he doesn't know that. He can't see outside the cistern, or as he's being dragged to Egypt, he can't see how this is going to turn out for good. So this morning I've entitled the message, Dark Providence, because I want to acknowledge that there's a bigger story, but I also want to acknowledge that in the moment, Joseph can't see that. He can't see the light at the end of the tunnel. And I want to ask us this morning to enter into his weeping or his sorrow. To do so knowing that, again, a bigger story, there's good coming, but to see if we can enter for a few moments and not simply say, keep calm and carry on, Joseph. It's not that bad, Joseph. At least you didn't die. It's going to be okay, Joseph. Just hang in there a little longer. Or something good's coming, Joseph. It's going to take about 20 years, but something good is coming. Just wait for that. Which is sometimes, not always, but sometimes the response I think we give one another when we find either ourselves or others in the cistern or in a time of dark providence. Yes, there's a bigger story. Yes, God's in charge. Yes, there's providence. But for Joseph in this morning, he can't see that. And this morning, I want to encourage us this in this story, but also in our lives, and this might sound maybe a little weird for some of us, but I want to encourage us a little weeping, a little understanding, a little commiserating with others, a little empathy that leads to maybe some tears in our eyes or in our hearts when we hear about the suffering of others. Jesus suffered so that we don't have to suffer forever. Jesus cried so that we don't have to cry forever. How awful to think that our tears would have to last forever. But in the moments of pain and suffering, I think we need a few more tears or a few more moments of just being quiet and silence. So as I was getting ready this week for our bulletin, and you know, bulletin deadline is Friday morning, usually on Thursday, I'm starting to think about the bulletin, especially the prayer corner. You know, I usually put the things in the prayer corner most Sunday mornings. And I was thinking about all the things going on in our world. Now, first of all, in our church community, there are people who are aging, people who are sick, people who are grieving. I didn't put this in the prayer corner, but I know there are people who are lonely, feel abandoned. There are parents who are wondering what's happening to their son, and the list can go on. There's always things I know, many things that we don't know about. So I just think about all the pain in our church community. And then I think, you know, picking up from Vanessa's sharing this morning, I think about the First Nations people and all the pain they've experienced. My contention is that reconciliation in this country will not happen if we don't mention the name of Jesus. If we don't bring Jesus into the reconciliation. That's one of my challenges when I hear about different things going on in our country, trying to reconcile our country with First Nations people. I want to say amen. I don't hear much about the name of Jesus. It's his ministry that reconciles people together. But even having said that, I wonder if we as a church, and I include very much myself, if we cry enough, if we lament enough, if we sit long enough in the cistern, in some sense, in the pit, with people who don't feel reconciled, First Nations people or people around us. And then this week has been unbelievable in terms of the news. Like, I don't remember a week like this. I know every week is tough in the news. But this week, shootings, one, two, and then shooting police in Dallas. Like, part of me says, I can sort of understand it. I know. I'm saying when you start shooting police, the society is in trouble, big trouble. And there's lots of things maybe I or we'd want to say about that, but I wonder as a church if we weep enough. And I say that because I don't weep enough. Something's happened. I'm sorry, in my heart is really awful. I don't weep enough. And I think, knowing a little bit who I am, and I'm not saying this is true of you, but what's true of me sometimes is someone got shot in the States. Thankful it's not Canada. Policeman got shot in Dallas. Good thing it wasn't Vancouver. We're nice and safe over here. We're nice and safe. I want to be safe. And I just confess that to you because there's something wrong happening in my heart, at least. When I hear about things going in other parts of the world, and I somehow think, well, either it's not happening here, or that's not me. That's not us. And then I read a story like this, from Genesis 37, or other awful stories, and this is the human condition. We hate people. Some of us, I'm not saying necessarily here this morning, but in our society, we want to kill people. And we might want to be all protected from what's going on. But I know that in my heart, there's not enough just mourning and grieving and crying over what's going on. Again, it could be the world, could be Canada, certainly, or my own life. And so this morning, although I believe there's a bigger story, I know there's a bigger story, I want to tell us the bigger story, and I don't want to get stuck this morning here in this story, I am asking us, could we wait a little bit before we tell people, before we tell ourselves, there's a better story coming, there's good coming, it's all going to be okay. Just say, man, that has got to be awful. That's got to be awful where you are in the pits, which is an image the Bible picks up later on, Psalm 40. I was in the pits, God. And for those of us this morning who are in the pits or in the cistern or we can't see the lights, I think one of the things we need to do as church is to say, that's got to be awful. I'm tempted to give you the spiritual religious answer, which needs to come. But in this moment, let me just say, how can I just sit with you or be silent with you or cry with you or acknowledge how awful this must be for you instead of jumping to an answer that, again, needs to come but is premature before we hear them weeping and crying and maybe also we hear ourselves weeping and crying over what's happening. In a few moments, we're going to hear a song. And I was wondering, what song do we sing right now? That's a tough one. We could pray and just move on with the service. But usually, we like to have a song. And this song is a really tough song. It's based on the Bible. So I like that. It's based on Job 13:15. I'm going to read just a little bit of this. The story of Job is like the story of Joseph. It's like the story of Jesus. Maybe it's a little bit like your story this morning. But this is what Job says in chapter 13. Keep silence and let me speak. Now this is actually powerful counsel to me or anyone who talks to people, listens to people who are in trouble. The best thing is be silent for a while. Let people talk. Then let come to me what may. Why do I put myself in jeopardy and take my life in my hands? And then these very challenging, raw words. We're going to hear that in a few moments. Though God slay me, yet will I hope in him. I will surely defend my ways to his face. Now that is a tough verse. And this is going to be a tough song. I don't think most of us will know it. I'm just going to ask us to listen to it. But I'm going to see if God can give us grace to believe this song. At the same time, for some of us, not singing the song too quickly to each other, right? Allowing people to grieve and cry and scream because of the situation they're presently in.
I come, God, I come, return to the Lord, the one who's broken, the one who's torn me apart. You struck down to bind me up, you say you do it all in love, that I might know you in the suffering. Though you slay me, yet I will praise you. Though you take from me bless your name, though you ruin me, still I will worship, sing a song to the one who's all I need. My heart and flesh may fail, the earth below give away, with my eyes, with my eyes, I'll see the Lord. Lifted high upon that day, behold the Lamb that was slain, and I'll know every tear was worth it all. Though you slay me, yet I will praise you. Though you take from me, I will bless your name. Though you ruin me, still I will worship, sing a song to the one who's all I need. This cup pass from me now. You're still more than I need. You're enough for me. You're enough for me.
How long, Lord? Will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I wrestle with my thoughts and day after day have sorrow in my heart? How long will my enemy triumph over me? Look on me and answer, Lord my God. Give light to my eyes, or I will sleep in death. And my enemy will say, I've overcome him. And my foes will rejoice when I fall. But I trust in your unfailing love. My heart rejoices in your salvation. I will sing the Lord's praise, for he has been good to me.
Though you slay me, yet I will praise you. Though you take from me, I will bless your name. Though you ruin me, still I will worship, sing a song to the one who's all I need. Sing a song to the one who's all I need.